This Dharma talk was recorded live at the Austin Zen Center in Austin, Texas. If you enjoy these talks and wish to support the temple and its offerings, please visit austinzencenter.org. Thank you for listening.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Hello, everybody online. I thank you all for coming out on what's supposed to be a holiday weekend. As you mostly know, I think Monday is a slack day in our schedule. We don't have morning or evening zazen, and so these three-day weekends don't mean anything to me. It's not a day, it's just another Monday. But anyway, I appreciate the fact that this is the first official weekend of summer by some reckonings, so the weather at least is cooperating. I want to begin this talk with a teaching story, or koan. You may have heard that word, to start off with. And for those of you who like looking these things up for yourselves, it's in the Book of Serenity, which is also called the Book of Equanimity in some translations, which is a collection of these kinds of stories. And it's case number 20. So it's a dialogue between two monks, Dizong and Fion. So Dizong asks Fion, who looks like he's going somewhere, "Where are you going?" And Fion says, "Around on pilgrimage." And literally, it means to travel by foot, go on foot. But in a Buddhist context, this is usually understood as what we mean by pilgrimage, a particular destination. Dizong said, "What is the purpose of pilgrimage?" Why not stay here? We have a temple. Fion, the monk, says, "I don't know." And Dizong said, and this is a famous response, "Not knowing is most intimate," or sometimes this is translated as, "Not knowing is closest or nearest," right? Somehow, you know, within. So mostly we seize on the not knowing, right? The not knowing part of this koan, and then the most intimate. When I hear about not knowing about something, I usually feel a little uneasy. I don't know how to do something, or I didn't know about something that happened and I'm operating with incomplete information and I don't like it. It's not a comfortable feeling, right? And I want to read a little short commentary on this koan, which is offered along with the story itself in this collection of the Book of Serenity. So there are these little poems that accompany these stories. So this is the little commentary poem. "Let it be short or let it be long. Stop cutting and patching. Going along with the high, along with the low, it levels itself. The abundance or scarcity of the house," the house is understood as the house of practice, "is used according to the occasion. Roaming serenely on the land, they go wherever their feet take them." So that's a little poem. Now these poems are often even more obscure than the actual koan story, right? But I think one thing to notice is to roam serenely and to go wherever your feet take you. So I wanted to bring up this koan because what this talk is about is to share with you the 10 days that I spent in Japan in April with a group of members of AZC. There were four of us, including me, and about a dozen or so from the Houston Zen Center, traveling as a group and joining other practitioners of our particular school of Zen. So it was a total of 85 people traveling to reach a particular destination, Japan. And this trip, the first few days of it in particular, was sponsored by the Soto Shu, or the Soto School of Zen Buddhism, right? Our way of practicing Zen, which is headquartered in Tokyo. So we all went to Tokyo. Some people traveled before, some people traveled after this particular arrival moment that we were supposed to all show up in Tokyo. And so it was a big mob. It was a very large group of people. And the Soto Shu called the event that occasioned this this trip, they called it a tour in English, right? And we were from North and South America, from Hawaii and Europe. So four different kind of quarters of the world where Soto Zen is practiced and where these temples are sort of registered. And the purpose, the tour, was of the two main training monasteries of our branch of Buddhism, right? So the word tour brings up for me tourism, and there's some negative connotations to that, and tourists, also some negative connotations, right? And right now, Japan, actually, we witnessed this, is in a moment of over-tourism. It was closed longer than some countries, and when they reopened, like, everybody who wanted to go suddenly showed up. And also, the yen is weak against other currencies, so, shoulder to shoulder, packed into most famous sites and all of the public transportation, really, really a lot of people on the move, which is great for the economy, but not so great for other reasons. So I also, whenever I go to a place where I have any familiarity or feel a personal connection with, I don't want to be a tourist, right? You know, so that's another thing. When I saw that word tour, I thought, no, you know, I've been practicing Zen for 25 years. I'm not a tourist. Anyway, this word tour kind of captured our itinerary, especially at the end, because after the first 3 days of being part of this Soto Zen event, which I'll explain in a moment, we really became tourists, the 15 or so of us from Houston. There was one person from San Antonio Zen Center also, and from here, we all like just went to Kyoto and visited temples and gardens, and we bought souvenirs, and we ate good food, and we, right, we were tourists. But Houston, the Houston Zen Center abbot, who many of you have encountered, Abbot Galen Godwin, in all of the communications that she offered to us as we tried to, prepare for this trip, she called it a pilgrimage. And she referred to us travelers as pilgrims. So what kind of, let me ask, what kind of connotations does the word pilgrim have for you all, as opposed to tourist? Or let's say in contrast to tourist.
Spiritual, religious.
Spiritual.
That's what I was going to say.
Yes.
Reverence.
A seeker.
A seeker. And Ed says a seeker. A seeker. A pilgrim is a seeker.
Simplicity.
Strenuous. Ooh, strenuous. Can be.
I guess as opposed to a tourist, earnest, like really wanting to experience something as opposed to being a consumer.
Okay, not so much consuming.
Yeah.
I was gonna say return and history.
Return, history, even if you've not been to the place, there's some sense of that. I think those of us who, all of us who came for the Soto Shu part, were all practitioners. Not all of us were priests, were teachers, but we were all practitioners of Soto Zen. And that's what they intended. They wanted people from all these different places to come. And the temple, these temples that we visited, first two, are not actually open usually to either tourists or just regular folks. You can go, but you can't enter the practice there. And they're parts of the both complexes that are not, they're closed off to people who are not part of the community. So we were, there was a real intention to invite us into these places. To me, at least, this word pilgrim, is a traveler, often under one's own power, Although I have to say, there's some Japanese pilgrimages that are so strenuous that you can actually do part of it with by bus, right? You can do the long sections by bus, and then you kind of go to the temple and you do the observances and you get your book, you know, inscribed and stamped that shows I've been here, and then you go on to the next one. So there are some workarounds for people who feel strongly they need to go, but they can't actually do it all under their own power. So a pilgrim, I think, for me, is a traveler. And it's sometimes said that we're all pilgrims, right? We're travelers through life. We are going through life. We have a beginning point and apparently an end point. But the travel and the route of a pilgrimage, I think, a kind of time and space that we carve out of our everyday life of being pilgrims in our lives, there's like a pilgrimage within the pilgrimage. And in this case, Japan, right? This is the destination, you know, follows a fixed route often, has a destination or destinations, Mecca, maybe Rome, Jerusalem, or many, many, many other places across the world. And you can also, maybe sometimes the destination is like to reach the grave of a saint, or a place where something happened that was really definitive for the faith community that you're in.
Bodh Gaya.
Mm. Yeah, biggie, thank you. Obvious one for us, right? Bodh Gaya. Yeah, I mean, globally, there are many, many, many. And there's also a kind of sense of merit, right, in making the pilgrimage. And sometimes it's an obligation. It's an obligation for believers in certain faiths to go, if they possibly can, to make the Hajj, for example, once in your lifetime. And you join other travelers and you devote yourself to the journey and nothing else. So the simplicity is the focus, right? You're on the road and you're heading for your destination. And the road is the pilgrimage also, not just the destination. So there are also some occasions, right, for pilgrimage that maybe are more auspicious than others. You can do the pilgrimage anytime, but if you are, you know, in Rome at Easter, let's say, if you're Catholic, that's a big deal, right? So it's not just a route through space, but there's also a temporal aspect, right, through time. And so that's why we were there in April, not just because it's a nice time, right? We just missed the cherry blossoms, actually, but we all thought, how about coming in? So some people went early so they could catch the cherry blossoms, but the date was significant as well as the space. So there are two main training temples of the Soto school in Japan, as I said. And the first one, many of you may have heard of, Eiheiji, which was founded by Dogen, who is our founder of Soto Zen. Usually we think of him as the founder, right? The person who brought this practice of Zen, particular practice of Zen, from China to Japan. And now this is the 13th century of our era, right? Over 700 years ago. Actually 800 years ago now. So Dogen actually made a kind of pilgrimage to China. No small thing in the 13th century. People died trying to get to China. The route is across this sea that is often very stormy. He made it, and he made it back. And he had an intention, if not a specific destination. He wanted to find a true teacher. He wanted to find someone who would answer his questions or help him to understand. And his question, for those of you who don't know, was, if we are all inherently Buddha, if we are all already Buddha, why do we need to practice? Why do we spend our time facing the wall? Why do we do these ceremonies? No one could give him an answer that he was satisfied with in Japan, so he went to China, hoping that he would find an answer there. And he went around to many teachers until he found the one that helped him to see. So he was following this long and ancient tradition already established of going around to different teachers in China before this time, back in the Tang Dynasty, and studying with them or testing oneself against them. Sometimes people say, I've got it, and now I'm going to go and talk to this teacher and see if they'll verify me, right? If they'll say, yes, you've got it. Doesn't usually go so well. You think you've got it? Now I'm here to tell you otherwise. you know, and sometimes the teachers are recommended by other teachers, so there's a kind of destination. But these traveling monks would travel, you know, for years, hundreds, thousands of miles on foot. We don't know how they sustained themselves. We don't know. They just entrusted themselves to the road and to the journey. And the koans, like the one we began with, are full of such stories. Right? And maybe you're one of these people, right? One of these itinerant seekers who are going around to different temples or retreat centers or traditions in search of something. Right? I think we're all here because of some impulse like that. So that's the first monastery, Aheji, which is way up north and was founded by Dogen himself. Very remote location, 7 feet of snow in the summer, in the winter, still cool in the summer when, or the beginning of summer when we were there, and not easy to get to even today. The second monastery is called Sojiji, and it was founded by a successor of Dogen's, three generations of teachers. And the third successor's name is Keizan. So how many of you have heard of Keizan? Keizan Zenji. Yeah, some of you adepts know about him. Okay, good. So Keizan is sometimes much less familiar to people practicing Soto Zen. And I think especially in North America, this is true. We read the Shobogenzo, the teaching of Dogen. We chant it in our morning service. And we revere Dogen as this kind of genius, you know, this spiritual genius who, in a relatively short life, he died at 53, did all this, you know. The Shobogenzo, if you're not familiar with it, is like this big fat book. And it's not the only record that he left, but, you know, it was his major teaching. And you can study it for a lifetime and still, you know, keep going. So Keizan, this third successor, founded at this temple called Sojiji. And it was originally located in the north of Japan also, and not that far from Aheji. And it was there for hundreds of years, actually. But about 100 years ago, they moved it. They moved the location to Yokohama, which is close to Tokyo, because Tokyo was becoming the modern capital of Japan. That's where all the action was. And so there was a decision made to move the temple there. And it's now the biggest temple. It's bigger than Aheji. It's more wealthy than Aheji. It has more monks than Aheji. All of this came as a sort of shock to some of us. It's partly because of the location. But it's also because of Keizan. Keizan never even met Dogen. He's considered, though, by Soto Shu in Japan as the second founder of Zen. So we have, if you go upstairs to our little cabinet at the top of the stairs, our founder's shrine, on the sides, there are two little scrolls, and on one side is Keizan, and the other side is Dogen, looking at each other. Right? So they're considered equally important. So Aheji is revered as the oldest temple of our school, and Sojiji is larger and more influential, with more sub-temples and training monks and all of that. And there is a kind of rivalry, and actually, in the 19th century, they sort of buried the hatchet, so to speak, and decided, yeah, okay, we're just gonna like cooperate, but they actually maintain slightly different traditions in terms of practice. It's interesting if you're into this sort of thing. So pilgrimage, occasion for our journey was the 700th anniversary of Keizan Zenji's death, 700 years ago. And although we revere Dogen especially, right, Keizan is extremely important, and the 700th anniversary was planned for years in Japan, even during the pandemic. They were planning this and hoping, you know, that the country would be open. So we didn't do any ceremonies for Keizan, despite this shared founder status. We didn't do any ceremonies for him at Aheji. That was really the tour part of the Soto Zen tour. We went there. We were shown around, we offered incense to Dogen, and then we got on buses and left after 3 hours. But Sojiji was a whole different story. So we took two trains, went to northern Japan, this is the tourist part, right? We toured Aheji in the way I just mentioned, and the next day we turned around and went back exactly where we had come from. We went to Sojiji near Tokyo. And that evening, we had a lecture from the Eno, the head of the meditation hall, who actually spoke English. He spoke good English, which was helpful to those of us who don't understand Japanese. And we got a very fancy bento box Japanese style dinner, temple cuisine, for all of us, 100 of us, 85 of us. And we had a Japanese bath. And then we all slept in a kind of dormitory style on the floor. The snoring was remarkable. I've never heard that. There were more men than women, and you know, a lot of them middle aged. It was like pillows over our heads. And the women, we were all getting up in the middle of the night and constantly going to the bathroom. So that was nobody got any sleep. And we were awakened at 3:20 a.m. by a piped in amplified wake up bell. Ding, 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 ding. And then we did Zazen at 4 in the morning. This is kind of extreme, even for us, I have to say. We went to a special Zendo to sit Zazen because the regular training monks were in their Zendo. So they have a special place just for us. And we were, I think, in so much shock that we were totally silent. And then we joined the regular morning service with the monks, which goes on for about an hour. And then after that, in the course of the morning, we had a break in the middle to get breakfast finally. We did a special ceremony for Keizan. And we did it 4 times in a row, rinse and repeat, exactly the same ceremony 4 times in a row. And the only difference was there was a different officiant, a different priest presiding. And so one priest represented North America, one represented South America, one represented Hawaii, one represented Europe. And every time, all of us, 100 of us, went up and offered incense to Keizan. And they had like 8 incense containers. So we all went up together. When the 8 of us got there, we all bowed together. We all offered chip incense. Then we moved out of the way. And the next 8 people came up. And this went on and on and on, right? And there were also special food offerings, which were passed hand to hand through 11 people and then brought to a special shrine where Keizan is venerated at Sojiji and only the abbot can enter. And they did all this, and they hosted us, and they made these special meals, and they made all these arrangements for us after they had already done 3 weeks of special ceremonies at Sojiji. They had just finished the day before in honor of Keizan. And still, and this is part of the, you don't know, like what is going to meet you on the road, we were met with complete enthusiasm. We were, you know, just, nobody said, oh, we're so tired, we can't wait for you all to leave. It was like, welcome, a huge welcome. We were served this delicious temple cuisine. We also had a fancy breakfast that most of us couldn't even finish. And then they gave us all these gifts as we were leaving, incense and all kinds of little, I guess what we call it, swag. We all got swag. The incense, though, was very, very nice. Big, long sticks of incense. We'll use it here over the course of the next year or two. And the care and appreciation for us was really sincere and really moving. And, you know, as I said, then the next day, the Houston and Austin group went off on our own. But before we went and got to be full tourists, we went on a little pilgrimage within the pilgrimage. We went to Rinso-in. And Rinso-in is a temple midway between Tokyo and Kyoto. And it's where Suzuki Roshi, the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center, came from and practiced. And, you know, people kind of like, I don't know, they downplay it. Compared to Eheiji, it's not so impressive. Compared to Sojiji, it's not so impressive. But it's 550 years old. And it's an important place, as it turns out. This was our own destination. This was our own little pilgrimage to our founder, to our closest founder, Suzuki Roshi. So that was an amazing encounter for us because the family of Suzuki Roshi, his son Hoitsu's family, who live there and take care of the community there, the families who are registered with that temple and whose graves of their ancestors are there. They were positively giddy to see us. I mean, you can't fake this, right? Mm-hmm. They were so happy that we came. We had to make a kind of big, you know, detour. And they served us tea and they served us mochi and they took us up to the abbot's cemetery, which they had cleaned up for us. And it had been raining, but they brought dry incense and matches so that we could all offer incense to Suzuki Roshi's marker. And I was really impressed that the markers for all of the abbots were there going back 550 years. The first abbot's marker is just a stone. It's a water-worn stone with moss growing on it. There's no name inscribed on it, but we know it's the first abbot. And it reminded me of Suzuki Roshi's marker at our training temple at Tassajara, which is a large water-worn stone from the creek that runs through Tassajara in California. So I now wonder if Suzuki Roshi had the original founding abbot's stone in mind when he chose his own stone for this, for his marker. And some of the other abbot's stones are so worn that the names can't be read anymore. And they're like, it's some abbot, you know, there's this continuous chain though of custody, you know, of the practice in the temple. And then after that, we went down the hill to the cemetery where the rest of the community graves are, and we all offered incense to Suzuki Roshi's wife, who's buried there, who died at just over 100, I think, not too long ago. So this was really moving to us, and I think it speaks to that part. I had never been there, but it speaks to that part of feeling connected to a place without having been there. Because they said to us in English, this is home, this is your home, please come back, please stay, come and stay. And to feel welcomed in that way, when you know you kind of know you're never gonna get into this all male training, you know, context in Sojiji or Aheiji, they're all young men training there to take over their family temples, to go to Suzuki Roshi's temple and feel completely included in a place that's almost as old as, you know, Sojiji, really moved all of us. And we didn't want to leave. We were kind of lingering, you know, we didn't want to go. So that was, in some ways, the heart of the pilgrimage for some of us, at least. So a little bit about Keizan to close this out, and just about the meaning of this trip, I think, as I've been processing it for the last few weeks. I have to say, I keep waking up thinking about Japan. And then I come here and I'm like, I'm here, it's Japan. I wouldn't be here without Japan. Excuse me. So the current abbot of Sojiji is a man named Shuko Ishizuki Zenji. That's his honorific name. And he made a kind of declaration about the 700th anniversary of Keizan. And he said the theme of this anniversary is Sojo in Japanese. And this means something like inheritance and transmission. And then he commented, so Sojo, he said. And then he said, can you hear the sound of the great footsteps? And these two characters, kanji, so and jo, literally mean mutual and together and each other, right? And then to listen to and receive. So it's a mutual transmission back and forth. When we think of inheritance, I think, like, you know, it's coming down from the past to us and then we pass it on. But I think the teaching in this is it's a two-way street. The past to us and us to the past as well as to the future. And the abbot urged that this occasion where we were all present, all of these people of all different colors and sizes, speaking different languages, and, you know, their own languages. I heard Italian, Spanish, Portuguese, right? You know, all sorts of languages. We were all the same in some really fundamental way. He wanted this occasion of us all coming to Japan, coming to his temple, to help us to understand this intimacy of succession, the teaching, the Dharma, passing from country to country, time to time, place to place. It changes and yet it doesn't change. Something fundamental about it doesn't change. Even though it takes on different bodies, different identities, different clothing, different cultures. And that, you know, it goes in both directions and it goes in all directions. So this inheritance has this deeper meaning. It's a kind of two-way communication. It's not just something that that's given to us and we have to preserve, right? No, we do 9 bows. We can't do 3 bows, right? It has to be this way. That's not the spirit of it. But the spirit of the Dharma is what we need to preserve. And so that first character of Sojo is also found in the word for ancestor. Right? The great footsteps that he mentioned are Keizan's footsteps. Right? Can you hear his footsteps? He's with us. He's on the path with us. He's on the road with us. He's a pilgrim like us. And this word so also appears in the honorary titles, and we don't hear very often, but of both Dogen and Keizan. Dogen is Koso. Koso meaning illustrious ancestor, like, you know, the great shining ancestor. And Keizan is Taiso, which means great ancestor. Right? There's not really much difference between those two. Founding ancestor and succeeding ancestor. There are ancestors. Right? They really are. In the way the Japanese think about this, all of our ancestors. And so, you know, we usually study and focus our gratitude on Dogen because he left us this big teaching. And we don't often study or recite all of it by any means, but we do delve into it and try to understand it. But the history of Soto Zen is that without Keizan, Soto Zen might not have survived. It would not have become so firmly established and fled and spread and flourished. And so this is what you should know about Keizan. He included lay people. This was his secret. In some ways, Dogen is seen as the founding father, kind of strict, severe, disciplinarian. But Keizan is the one who said, we must include everyone. This is really what Dogen was trying to do, like Zazen is for everyone. But the whole training aspect of it, the monk aspect of it, doesn't include everyone. And Keizan wanted it to become a practice that lay people could do. And he, in that way, kind of perpetuated Buddha's teaching of the fourfold Sangha. That was the original teaching. And the fourfold Sangha is lay women and men and ordained women and men. You need all of it. And the closeness, the mutuality of what we call priests or monks and lay people was something that Keizan insisted on, right? That this is how we will practice going forward. He also was very close to women in his family and women who were his students. He was actually raised partly by his grandmother, who was one of Dogen's early supporters. She was a wealthy woman and ultimately became a monk herself. That's the connection through time, really, the close connection between Dogen and Keizan. And he actually, Keizan this is, constructed the first Soto women's monastery. And women can also practice this way, in this very kind of intensive way, not just the men. And if you ever hear us chant the women ancestors, we have a list of women ancestors, which has been created really in the 20th century. You'll hear some names that turn out to be Keizan's family and supporters and these early women teachers. And Keizan is also the last Soto ancestors that all Soto Zen lineages have in common. After that, you know, it continued to spread and bifurcate. So I really felt, trying to wrap this up, I really felt one result for me of this pilgrimage is to feel in a more visceral way how important Keizan is, right? I don't think there'd be women practicing the way they are in the West in particular without Keizan. And the fact that we are practicing as lay people, we're practicing Zazen, we sit retreats, we eat with Oreo key bowls. Our Japanese colleagues are coming here to experience this. They want to bring this back to Japan, because currently, mostly it's priests and monks who sit Zazen and not so much lay people. And so they come here, they actually come here, and maybe they say, oh my God, I can't believe they bow like that. But, you know, and then they teach us some forms, but it's the actual spirit of people like all of us, right? Practicing in this way, which is also what Suzuki Roshi deeply believed in, the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center. They emphasize this to us over and over again. This is also the two-way transmission, right? That it goes out and then it comes back home. And we can learn from each other. There's a mutual understanding of the importance of the Dharma, the spirit of the Dharma, and then how to share it, how to keep it going, how to make it alive. And in Japan, it's under a lot of pressure. There are many temples that are closing. There's a demographic crash in Japan. Many old people and not that many younger Japanese. So how can they make it more relevant to modern life? And that is by bringing it back to lay people, the teaching and the practice. I want to just give you a taste of what Keizan's teaching is like, since we don't often study it. You'll see the contrast maybe, and maybe the way, the complementarity of his teaching to Dogen's. This is from his instructions for Zazen. And we studied, some of you will be familiar with this because we studied it 2 years ago during our practice period. But let me just give you a paragraph, short paragraph. This is from his text called Zazen Yojinki, which means something like advice on Zazen or points to consider in Zazen. So these are the opening lines. What he says about our Zazen practice. Sitting, he says, is the way to clarify the ground of experience and to rest at ease in your actual nature. Also could be translated as true nature or Buddha nature. This is called the display of the original face. Sometimes we hear the face before your parents were born. That's another koan. And it's sometimes called revealing the landscape of the basic ground, the fundamental ground of our experience. Keizan says, drop through this body mind and you will be far beyond such forms as sitting or lying down, beyond consideration of good or bad. Transcend any divisions between usual people and sages. Pass beyond the boundary between sentient beings and Buddha. Putting aside all concerns, shed all attachments. Do nothing at all. Don't fabricate any things with the six senses, right? Don't make up reality with your minds. Who is this then? Who's this who's not doing anything? He says, its name is unknown. It cannot be called body. It cannot be called mind. If you try to think of it, the thought vanishes. If you try to speak of it, words die. It is like a fool. It's like an idiot. It is as high as a mountain. It is as deep as the ocean. Without peak or depths, its brilliance is unthinkable. It shows itself silently. Between sky and earth, only this whole body is seen. So next time you sit, think about that before you think about nothing. So I think Keizan brings me back to not knowing. Right? This is not knowing. This is the not knowing of Zazen, not knowing who we are. Not having a particular name, not having a particular form, merging heaven and earth right here where we're sitting. You know, we don't know why our hearts impel us to question, to wonder about the purpose of our lives, who we are, how to be human, all of these questions and problems that we have, right? Why do we hit the road? Why do we hit the cushion? You know, this is the kind of asking what that is the core of Zen practice. Right? It's the Buddha that we are that takes up this practice to express this reality. And, you know, I didn't know when I went to Japan what it would really be like. I had made a quick trip in 2011, so a long time before. You know, I didn't know how I'd be affected by my fellow pilgrims, by the conditions, by the lack of sleep, you know, by all of it. But the most powerful things for me were Eheiji, just to be in that space of Dogen. And then, as I said, Rinso-in, Suzuki Roshi's temple. And it made me really grateful, really, really grateful this practice is here in America, and to feel like we are not just part of it, but we are critical to it. The way of our way of practice is critical to this much greater world of Zen. And all beings are Buddha. All beings are Buddha nature. Keizan and Dogen both included women as students and patrons and transmitted the Dharma to them. And they ran their own temples, but this sort of got lost over the course of centuries. And, you know, now as of early fall, all three temples in our lineage in Texas will have women as guiding teachers or abbots. So that's a revolution. And actually, I have to say, Galen, the abbot of Houston Zen Center, is part of this. She was chosen as the first Westerner and the first woman to be the representative of Soto Zen in North America. And her talk, she gave a short talk also in Tokyo when we got back from Sojiji, and her talk was basically to say, Keizan included women, why aren't you? To, like, you know, the president of Soto Shu, who was there, very serene, he didn't react. So there, the gender aspect, the lay aspect, these are two things that we are confronting here and are working with here, and they want to know how we're doing it. So I want you to know how important you are. In case you didn't know, you're important back in the homeland of Zen. Now you have it. Keep it well. Mm-hmm. Thank you for listening. I think we have about time for just maybe if anybody has any questions or comments or reflections. Rich.
So you're saying that they want to emulate what we're doing here, but do they have in Japan anything like a Zen center? Or is it just temples and monasteries, is that?
It's temples and monasteries because that is the age-old structure, you know?
Yeah.
But there are a few people who are experimenting more with kind of bringing in everyday life into the local temples. So for example, there are some temples where they're inviting in they call it the Dhanka, so it's the congregations, the Dhanka, and doing things like sharing the traditions of temple food, which is it's vegan, right? Vegan, vegetarian, as a way, like we're doing in this country, like, you know, mindfulness, right? That's the hook. Some people come in through that door and then find the whole world that produced, you know, the whole realm of teachings that produced the mindfulness teachings. Mindfulness is great. It's a wonderful thing, but it doesn't include the precepts, for example, the ethical underpinnings of Buddhism. So this is a way of like getting people in, like in Japan, the traditional cuisine is healthy, but everybody's eating junk food, you know. So through the temples to teach this traditional way of eating, this Buddhist way of eating, and then once they're in the door saying, would you like to learn Zazen? You know, including families, including children, you know, making it relevant to people's everyday lives in that way. And then there are a few teachers who are really kind of throwing out a lot of the monastic forms that we still use here to create programs that don't have, say, chanting services, you know. There's also summer camp for kids, like, you know, where, like, you can learn to be a Doan as a 5-year-old. Watch out. I'd love to make noise, right? So those are some of the things that they're sort of adopting from us, and some of the people doing this are people who have been elsewhere and spent time. There are some Ahaji monks who have come to Tassara or have come, and actually there was one who we encountered. He came to Suzuki Roshi's temple knowing that some people would be there that he had met when he was at Ahaji. And when he was at Tassara. And so, you know, the forms were similar, like Orioki, but like he got orange juice one day for breakfast and his mind was totally blown, you know. Orange juice in the second bowl doesn't exist in Japan. No. It's like, you know, miso soup, yes, orange juice. but I think the important thing is like, what's important? So they're incredibly careful attention to detail, that these Japanese trained monks, which is so impressive, not just because, you know, it's not like just watching, say, an army drill, you know, like you watch people who are trained in the ways of like the changing of the guard. That's really precise and, you know, kind of amazing. There's a certain choreography to it, but in this case, it's this totally merging with the activity, you know, that they're doing. And the chanting, of course, is, you know, I think that and the amazing amount of incense that we burned kind of transported all of us into a different realm. We were like stoned on the incense. And then the chanting was this, they do this thing, we chant one chant here, some of you will know it, the Daihishin Dorani, which is, you know, with the Mokugyo, you know, we chanted as a memorial service. And when it's a memorial service, we chant it sort of slow, you know, kind of, it's a little grave. And in order to make space for 100 people to offer incense during the space of the Daihishin Dorani, which normally takes 7 minutes or something, they chant, they said, they only do this at Tsuchiji, apparently. It was like, Namu Kara, instead of Namu Kara Tan no Torayaya, you know, like that slow. And so you got a hit on this enormous Mokugyo. It was like the size of a beach ball with a huge, you know, the guy was standing up on a ladder. Tonk. Tonk. It was, you know, it's like if you like this kind of thing, it was like, wow. The difference between, you know, going to the Justice of the Peace to get married and, you know, being like British royalty and having all the carriages. There's more than one way to do these things. But they did this 4 times in a row. Yeah. Incredible physical effort in a lot of these ceremonies. But it's all there it's not just there for the sake of pomp and circumstance. So that is not the usual way of practice in Japan either, right? They don't do that kind of thing in your normal, everyday, local temple. Yeah. It's become, as someone said, Zen in Japan has become more like funeral Zen. It's what you do when you need to bury somebody, or, you know, have a memorial service, or have somebody come to your home altar on the anniversary of, you know, a family member's death. And this whole movement actually began after the earthquake and tsunami in 2011, where what's the name of the place? I can't think of it now. Fukushima. Up in Sendai, Fukushima, you know, which also was such an environmental disaster. Of course, the priest came and tried to take care of the dead and set the cemeteries back to rights, because a lot of them were also overwhelmed by the wave. But how do we help the living? How do we help people with their grief, not just offering incense, but with the teachings? And then how do we help people with their everyday suffering? There's a high suicide rate in Japan. You know, how do we do that part of our bodhisattva vow? So that's where they're at. Yes.
Curious how what the family experience is in Buddhist practice. So my familiarity is more here, where the advertisements or billboards of families walking into churches or something like that, or experience that, you know, ourselves. But how does that come in, or does it come in?
It does come in. We have several ceremonies a year that are actually, you know, kind of more family friendly, like Buddha's birthday. We have a birthday cake. We sing happy birthday. You know, we have a procession. That's in the spring. But there are temples that have children's programs or children and family programs that are where you're trying to bring the Dharma in. And sometimes it's through very simple teachings that are like, you know, well, you've heard about sharing in school, right? So this is some mindfulness, right? And, you know, kind of everybody taking a turn is a way of helping kind of bring kids in that way. But I also know people who have run these programs in other places I've been. They're adamant that kids can sit still and do zazen. I mean, some kind of zazen. You don't just have to like make it Buddhism light. You know, like here, now we're going to have a snack and we're going to eat it silently and we're not going to grab each other's snacks and, you know, that actually they have them sitting and bring some of our ceremonial practice. There's like the most elaborate I've seen it in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, where I practiced for a long time. There was a kid's service with kid doans. And they did a pretty good job. The Mokugyo was kind of loud, but other than that, you know, here, for example, occasionally I get a question like, do you do anything with family and children? And it's like, do you want to help me start something? Do you have other families who would be interested? You know, come and talk to us. It's like by request, right? We don't just offer it and then let people show up or not, because it does take resources and it takes planning. So if you or anybody knows people who would like to help construct such a program, you know, for kids and families, let me know. I keep track of people who ask, and then, you know, sometimes I'll say, well, there's another person. Are you still interested in this? You know? Yeah. You're interested? Okay. Yeah. So yeah, just let us know. And, you know, we can try to facilitate something, but a Zen center kind of often works sort of step by step. It's like, what are people ready for, or what are people interested in? And some people will do a 7-day retreat and others will never try to undertake that. So we have like a morning retreat, you know, just like 8 to 12, no whistles and bells, no Dharma talks, no chanting. That works really well for some people, and a 7-day silent formal retreat doesn't. So, you know, try to make it available in various forms. And this is one that's just kind of like waiting. I have lots of resources if someone's interested in knowing more. Any other questions? Anybody online got any questions?
So I guess the usual way of looking at time is how directional and linear it is. But then when Elliot mentions returning, when you mentioned the mutuality of the soju, I wonder if you noticed any disruption of this linearity while you were on your pilgrimage.
I can say actually, yes, in the sense that maybe it would be better to say when I, after absorbing all of this and hearing all of this and feeling this kind of familiarity, you know, strangeness and familiarity both, the first morning I was back in the Zendo here, I really felt like I was in no particular place, and I was in that place. I was in Japan. It's, you know, the altar, the bowing mat, everybody seated, the bells, you know, it was a very, it wasn't disembodied exactly, but time wasn't so important and place wasn't even so important. So that was a little, you know, a little trippy. Maybe I was still jet lagged. I was sick when I got back, so it could have been a lot of things, but that was one way. But I think in general, you know, we can talk about the ancestors as a lineage means like linear, right? There's a founder, and then, you know, you kind of do the branching thing, right? The family tree, right? We're all familiar with that. But in Zen, we often say, and this is maybe the reality of it, becomes more apparent the longer we're with it, that the ancestors are here. They're not in the past. We are the ancestors. They're only alive. Their teaching and their realization only lives because of us. That's the passing on. And also, they appear when, you know, they're real because we practice. And there's a way of representing the ancestors, the lineage, what we call the lineage, that instead of being a line, it's a circle. And, you know, when we make a circle, we can all see each other, right? You can see everybody. And the center is Buddha or emptiness, out of which it all comes, right? So it's not linear in that sense. It has no direction. It's all directions. And the women's lineage that we sometimes chant, there is a document that's been prepared by some teachers that shows it as a circle. So you enter from any point. There is no original teacher. There's only one teacher. It's the one that's present. And there's only one student. It's whoever's in front of you. Right? One student is all students. It doesn't matter whether it's the Tang Dynasty or now. So let that marinate in that for a while. Yeah. Because I think so much we dwell on our differences, and we dwell on how different our modern, you know, life is from 13th century Japan. It's different, but it's not. We're still human, and we still come from our suffering. What is this life? What am I supposed to do? Who am I? Those questions have not changed at all. Okay. Yes?
Just one curious question. Was there anything that you saw there that you said, I'd like to bring that back with me?
You know, I don't think I would. I've really valued the times that I've spent in our monasteries, you know, in the San Francisco Zen Center monasteries. And I always, there's a part of me that always wants to be in Tassajara, you know, just that very simple life where you don't have to think about what you're going to eat or when you're going to eat it. You know, there's a time and place for everything. There's even a time to do your laundry. There's a, on the schedule, it's like room cleaning, half an hour on this day, right? Everything is taken care of. And there's a part of me that always wants to be in that kind of life, this very simple life. But I wouldn't, from where I am right now, here with you all, I would not actually, if you said, Tassajara, the rest of your life, pack your bags, I think I'd say, I don't think so, I'll stay here. So I really do think that this, the way we are practicing together, with all the challenges that we all have and bring in our incredibly diverse society with all of its stresses and strains and all the difficulties, we run towards it. We don't run away from it. We accept it. We sit down and it all comes to us, and then we embrace it. So, you know, monasteries feel like a place we can go to be peaceful, and then we want to get away from it, right? I went months without a cappuccino. I suffered. And, you know, unlimited hot water anytime I wanted. It was like, you know, you kind of feel like, freedom. But it's not, you know, what is our freedom? What's the most important thing about being, what is freedom? What is real freedom? What is true freedom? Yeah. So no is kind of the answer. And yet, I was envious of some people's robes. There were some really beautiful robes. Wow. But you know, we were all of us, no matter how high our status in Soto Zen at home, we were all asked to wear this basic, you know, black or brown, simple robe. Like, if you've got brocade, leave it at home, they told us. The only people who had the really fancy robes were the people who were officiating the ceremonies. So they were kind of carrying that formality and status for the rest of us. And the rest of us, no matter how important we were, you know, Galen wore this, you know, even though she's the head of Soto Zen in North America, because she wasn't an officiant. So, yeah, just like, okay, don't really need the fancy stuff. Fancy enough.